Henry Morton Stanley was certainly one of the greatest explorers of all time. And throughout his incredible life, which was packed with adventure and conflicts, he served as a soldier, a sailor, a journalist, an explorer, an empire builder, a statesman, an author, a politician, a lecturer, and finally he's even knighted by Queen Victoria. Bit of impact. Stanley is most famous for having found the missionary explorer Dr. David Livingstone after he'd been out of touch, out of contact with the outside world for many years, and his calm and most understated of comments, having crossed half the continent, Dr. Livingstone, I presume, must be one of the most famous statements in popular memory worldwide. Most people may not know the man, but they have heard the phrase. Throughout his life, Henry Morton Stanley experienced brutality, cruelty, extreme cruelty and brutality, starvation, disease, poverty, affliction, treachery, betrayal, and ultimately great honor and success and wealth. There are a lot of controversies that have arisen. Even in his hometown in Wales, in Denbigh, there is a campaign to try and get rid of the statue of this most famous son of Wales. Of all the great explorers of Africa, David Livingstone and Henry Morton Stanley stand head and shoulders above all the other explorers. They were very different men, but both of them made spectacular contributions to the development of Africa. Stanley stands out as a lot of exceptions. He's the only journalist to found an empire. His job was meant to be recording history, but actually he's most famous for having made history. He stands out as extraordinarily tough, persistent, a model of perseverance. Yet before his 24th birthday, Stanley had a long track record of frustration and failure, defeat and desertion. No one could have predicted how this extraordinary man would develop and rise above all others in his achievements, especially in bringing civilization to the Dark Continent. The life of Henry Morton Stanley is full of surprises. The first is, he wasn't born in America. The second is, he wasn't born with the name Henry Morton Stanley. He was baptized John Rowlands. That was believed to be the name of his father. He is born illegitimately, in disgrace, the child of 19-year-old Miss Elizabeth Parry. I don't believe there's any such thing as an illegitimate child, but there are illegitimate parents. But in those days, they blamed the child, which seems most unjust. Shortly after his birth, 28th of January, 1841, his mother abandoned him into the hands of his father. Her father, Moses Parry, ran off to London. Economic disaster reduced this man to living with his sons, and when the grandfather died, John Rowlands was just 4 years old, and so his two uncles dragged him off to this huge stone building, and he was seized, dragged in, and he became an inmate of St. Asaph Union Workhouse for the next 9 years. This was charity with a vengeance, and the homeless and unwanted were abandoned here. They had a very rigid schedule. It was a harsh, Spartan environment. There was a lot of work, meager food, rationed portions, one bath a week, scrubbed on Saturdays. Only relief was Sundays when they had two church services and no work. But the schoolmaster was an ex-miner, James Francis, who lost his hand in a mining accident, and he developed a vicious temper and a callous heart. And he took apparently savage pleasure in punching, caning, whipping, kicking, beating the children who had been entrusted into his care. And John Rowlands received his first flogging for mispronouncing a word. Very extreme. About 30 young boys at a time, the curriculum was primitive, and John vividly remembers some young boy, Willie Roberts, being beaten to death. And he was convinced James Francis had murdered Willie Roberts, who he saw in a dead house. John said he never missed his mother because he was 12 years old before he even learned that every boy has to have a mother. Yet even this depressing environment, he managed to distinguish himself with his drawings, mostly of cathedrals, which earned him a Bible from the bishop and a commendation. He even was selected to lead the workhouse boys' choir, and because of his exceptionally good memory, a school inspector pronounced him the most advanced pupil at St. Asaph. So in an area where you couldn't exactly distinguish yourself, he did distinguish himself. One person who remembered him later said John Rowlands was stubborn, self-willed, uncompromising, unusually sensitive, particularly strong. But at age 15, something happened which changed the whole direction of his life. They said but for this event, he might have ended up mildewed in Wales. But the sadistic schoolmaster, James Francis, wanted to cane the entire school, and he erupted in rage, and he wasn't willing to accept that nobody knew who had scratched the desk, so he wanted to whip the entire school. And as he assailed and beat mercilessly John Rowlands, laying into him, John aimed a kick into the schoolmaster's face, which broke his glasses, knocked him backwards, and he fell with his head hitting the stone floor, unconscious. Horror swept over the school. John fled over the fence to his paternal grandfather, a prosperous Welsh farmer, who told him to leave and never come back. His uncles were also hard-hearted. And he found one cousin willing to give him some lodging, some schooling, and while he loved books and learning, the other boys at school were merciless in teasing and bullying him because he was illegitimate. Well, after 9 months of schooling, he was taken to Liverpool, and then he had to make his own way in life at mere 16 years old. Well, soon he got himself a job as a deckhand on a ship, the Windermere, and he was abused there as well, had to climb up the rigging. I mean, imagine a young boy, and you've got to climb on the outsides of these rigging, high gales swaying. Not a place for a person who's scared of heights. Well, you can imagine, when they reached New Orleans, he jumped ship at the first opportunity and forgot about his salary. Who cares? He just wanted to be free. And now the sights and sounds of America fascinated him. And he met a kind man sitting in front of a shop in New Orleans, and he said, "Do you want a boy, sir?" Now, what he meant is, do you want someone for work? But the businessman was actually wanting to adopt a child, because while he's happily married, he is childless. And what was that, you said? And he inquired further, and he was quite attracted to this young man, who's obviously quite intelligent, and he determined to adopt him. And he got his first haircut, and he got his first job, and for the first time, he had money in his pocket, he had room and board, he had a good job, and he put all his money into books, building bookcases, reading, and he actually started to develop friends. He had never developed a friend. He was socially awkward. He had never learned how to handle affection. And the first friendship he developed was with Alice Heaton, who he thought was a boy, because she was a runaway who had managed to maintain her disguise as a sailor boy long enough to reach America, and managed to convince him, even though they shared a room for a long time, that she was a boy as well. And when he discovered otherwise, she fled. When Mrs. Stanley fell ill, John left his job at the store and devoted everything to her care until she died. And then he went looking for his potentially adoptive father in St. Louis. But when he got there, he had departed. And then he had an adventure on a flat-bottom boat, working his way back down the Mississippi to New Orleans, avoiding sandbars, steamboats, storms, dangerous currents, whirlpools. Very good training for the Congo River, which he would have to negotiate later. In New Orleans, John was reunited with Mr. Stanley, and in the first tender action he experienced in his life, he was embraced by Mr. Stanley. Next day, Mr. Stanley declared that he would adopt him in future years to bear his name, Henry Stanley. So Henry Hope Stanley adopted Henry, who later took the middle name of Morton Stanley. And he was mentored, he was taught, he was trained, he was lectured on morality and faith and work and culture and customs, and expect to read consistently. And his adoptive father continually would give him problems to solve. And Henry Stanley proved to have a phenomenal memory, and he soaked up all this teaching offered to him. The golden period of his life, he called it. One night in 1860, traveling on the Mississippi River, Henry was on deck when he saw a man enter his father's cabin with a knife in his hand, and he leapt at the man, grappled with him, putting the would-be robber and murderer to flight and experiencing only a gash in his coat. Well, he then was separated from his father's business, took his father to Cuba, and the last words of Henry Hope Stanley to him was, "Hold fast to Christian principles. Be fearless in all manly things." Soon, young Henry was laid low with malaria. And then the war between the states erupted, and he was stunned into joining the Confederate cause by a young girl sending him a petticoat in the mail, which is implication that he is a coward because he wouldn't join the army. So he joined the Confederate cause, and he got involved in the Arkansas Regiment, marched out, and They marched across many states, Georgia, Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, and finally in April 1862 they came to what was to become the bloodiest battlefield of the American war between the states, Shiloh. And you can see the Confederates are coming up from the south and they were attacking the defensive positions of the north. It was a very unwise battle. The Confederates were throwing 40,000 exhausted troops who had been marching for weeks against 50,000 fresh Union troops. Most of the Southerners were armed with flintlock muskets, muzzleloaders, while Northerners had modern breech-loading rifles with cartridges, and there were more of them. But Stanley's regiment was ordered to march straight towards the Union lines, and the musketry increased in volume, intensity, artillery shells flying overhead, branches were coming down, debris was falling on their heads, and they continued to march. And then the order was given, fix bayonets at the double quick. And the men in grey gave their battle cry, which they always did, surged forwards, and the figures in blue began to flee before them. And for the first time, Stanley experienced the exhilaration of victory. He thought the battle was won. Actually, it was just the beginning. Soon there was even more Yankees. Volleys of deadly fire ripped through the grey ranks. The ground erupted beneath them as they came under artillery fire. The air was thick with ricochets and flying metal. It didn't seem possible that anyone could survive in the face of such deadly barrage of lead. The command was given to dive for cover, and he saw men mangled and mutilated all around him. Then the Confederates ordered their men to stand and to charge, and they leapt to their feet with a great battle cry. They surged forward, and they were pounded with artillery fire, decimated by rifle fire, but they swept through another Union regiment. Then Stanley was knocked to the ground, and he discovered his belt buckle was bent and cracked, stopped a Union bullet, but he was unharmed. Many more charges ordered. Time and again, the Arkansas volunteers swept the Yankees reeling in retreat, and then torrential rain fell upon the battlefield. It took stock of the situation. They only had about 50 men left in the regiment. Another advance ordered, and he found himself isolated, surrounded by wild-eyed Union troops who just poured out hatred and cursed him and threatened to bayonet him, and he was staggered as he became a prisoner of war, ended up in the stinking disease factory of Camp Douglas, a filthy cattle pen where, without any hygiene, medical care, without any of the most basic needs for survival, they were just living amongst fleas and flies and rats and disease, and he saw vast numbers of soldiers debilitated, dying of dysentery, typhoid fever, without any help from their callous captors. At this point, the commissary, a kind man, persuaded Stanley to save his life by enlisting in the Union Army. You could at any time do so and end being a prisoner of war. Of course, most Confederates would never do that. But Stanley is a survivor, and he shows what he's done so often. He gives up. He changes sides. So far, that's the way he deals with everything. And he actually, which is very rare, very few Confederates did it, he joined the Union Army, but then came down with a fever so severe that he was discharged for health reasons. Then he walked across the coast, worked on a ship, and went all the way through to Liverpool, found his mother, and she told him that she wasn't interested, and he was literally turned away from his mother on the doorstep. And this left him feeling absolutely devastated and alone. So he worked his way back across the ocean on another ship to find his adoptive father, and he found his father died 2 years ago. Stanley's situation could hardly have been worse. He is homeless, penniless, without friends, without relations, afflicted by parasites he had picked up in prison. He didn't even have a country. He determined that he would never again consciously seek or expect human affection. He enlisted as a sailor, worked on merchant ships, went to the West Indies, Italy and Spain. He was shipwrecked off Barcelona. Lots of adventures in this young man's life. But 19th of July, 1864, he enlisted in the United States Navy for some reason, on the northern side. Only person I know who fought on both sides of the war. When he's asked about that lady, he said, "Oh, well, you know, we journalists will do anything for a story." The Union Navy records describes him as 5 feet 5 inches in height, which makes him quite short, with hazel eyes, dark hair, birthplace England. Presumably thought the Americans couldn't tell the difference between Wales and England. and probably wouldn't know what Wales was. And he served in the US Navy as the ship's writer because he loved books, and next thing he's writing about some land and sea battles as the ship's reporter, and these got published. And his attention to detail and his eyewitness accounts were considered remarkable. And so the positive comments he received from these articles and the success of having these reports published made Stanley start to think about becoming a journalist. 10th of February, 1865, Stanley deserts the Navy and becomes a roving reporter in the Wild West. It's remarkable that this man, who throughout the rest of his life developed the reputation as the most persistent and resilient of explorers, that this man, who never gave up, no matter what situation, against whatever odds, in the face of many dangers, that actually before he was 24 years old, Stanley had run away from school, jumped ship, deserted the Confederate cause, changing sides, deserted the US Navy in a time of war. These are pretty serious things. In fact, he got shot for doing things like that. No one at this stage of life could have anticipated what he would accomplish later in life. It just shows you should never decide too early. Like John Mark in the Bible, he deserted the Apostle Paul. Paul didn't want him back, but later Paul says, send for John Mark. He is much useful for me in the ministry. John Mark changed. So defeat doesn't have to be final. Failure doesn't have to be final. He traveled in the Wild West. He experienced Indian wars. He went to Turkey. He got ambushed by thieves, had everything stolen, was arrested for not having papers in Turkey. He wrote an account of the abuse he experienced in the Orient. That's a whole other story in its own. Went back to the Wild West. He joined the Indian Wars. He saw the battles under General Sherman and General Hancock, and he saw how Hancock negotiated with the Comanche and the Kiowa Indians in Nebraska and Kansas. And he said he learned a lot from how Hancock dealt kindly with these savage tribes who had been scalping and murdering and killing, and he expected to see them dealt with harshly. But instead, he saw General Hancock, who could be very harsh dealing with the Confederates, but he was apparently very kindly dealing with the Indians in dealing with them seeking resolution, peace. And he thought that's remarkable and said it guided him later when he worked in the Congo. At one point, Stanley met Wild Bill Hickok and interviewed him, and when he asked how many men he had killed, Wild Bill reported, considerably over 100 white men to a certain knowledge. He couldn't count the number of redskins, but about 100 white men. And he said, I never killed one without a good cause. One wonders what a good cause would have been to Wild Bill. But they became friends, and Wild Bill even beat up a man for saying something nasty to Stanley. Stanley reported on General Sherman's dealing with the Indians, and he said he learned a lot from these men. He said they dealt with the Indians as warriors and as children who must be taught and corrected. He said he learned to do the same when dealing with savage tribes in Africa. All this helps us to understand some of how Stanley came to be as he did. He wrote for many different newspapers, including the Herald. Interestingly enough, although he was a sailor and a soldier and a journalist in the Wild West, he was a teetotaler. He kept true to his pledge of abstinence when he was young, and he never touched drink except once in his life, which he bitterly repented of. Well, then he heard about the upcoming British war with Abyssinia, and so he persuaded James Gordon Bennett of the New York Herald to hire him as a special correspondent to Africa, and that was a major, vital turning point, not only in his life, but in history, including for Africa. He joined the expeditionary force of the British at the Red Sea port of Zula, Eritrea. The story is that King Theodora of Abyssinia had killed the former king, murdered him, had provoked the kingdom into rebellion through his cruelty and tyranny. He had antagonized the British Empire by assaulting their consul, Cameron, and the English missionary, Stern. And when envoys carrying letters of protest from Queen Victoria were arrested and abused and thrown to prison, the English diplomats were tortured, threatened in the most horrendous manner, and after unsuccessful attempts to ransom them, Britain declared war on King Theodora. And in 1869, dispatched an expedition of 12,000 troops of the Indian Army under Sir Robert Napier to secure the release of these hostages and to suitably punish Theodora. Here's the British fleet landing on the shores of British Somaliland to head off for the 400-mile march to Theodora's stronghold at Magdala. Colourful sights of Indian regiments, Punjab sepoys, Indian cavalry, English sailors with rockets and horse-drawn artillery and elephants and camels and horses and mules. And here's some of the elephants from India who've been brought over by ship to transport all kinds of weapons of war. You can see the siege cannons here, siege mortars being carried up the mountains in Abyssinia. What an incredible sight this must have been. Well, on 9th of April, the Abyssinian Expeditionary Force arrived at Magdala. And they didn't seem at all appalled by the impregnable site of this mountain stronghold perched on the top of Grand Mountain. The British military just marched across the river and proceeded up the mountain. Suddenly, 3,500 well-armed Abyssinian warriors swarmed down the slopes in a wild charge against the British. And Napier calmly ordered the naval brigade to take their positions. Action front. Naval brigade launched their rockets into the midst of these charging Abyssinians. We were thrown to terror and confusion by these strange weapons that they'd probably never even heard of. Then 300 men of the 4th were ordered forward, commanders given, commence firing. The British surged forward, the Abyssinians attempted a flanking maneuver, they were outflanked themselves by the bayonets of the sepoys, and at the end of the day, 560 Abyssinians were counted on the field dead, but not a single British soldier had been lost, although 32 were wounded. Theodora, now terrified by the British firepower that he had witnessed the day before destroying his best troops, he attempted to appease the British by releasing all their prisoners. And here are the prisoners. These are the people that the war was fought over, envoys, consuls, and missionaries. And Stanley noted with great surprise the lack of emotion expressed by both the captives, who had endured years of torment, and their liberators, who all seemed amazingly calm about the matter. And that's another insight as to why, when he met the Englishman, who was actually Scottish, David Livingston, he opted for the Dr. Livingston, I presume, calm, understated, because he thought this is the only way to deal with British people. This American hugging and all that, he obviously thought wouldn't work from what he had seen so far. So the next morning, the British marched up the mountain, began an artillery barrage on the stronghold, followed by an assault. Soon the British flags were flying on the walls and the bands were playing God Save the Queen. Theodora had had enough. He shot himself with his own pistol, and the archaeologist attached to the expedition sketched this portrait of the man himself. And here is Sir Napier observing the dead king, dead by his own hand, inside the walls of Magdala. These are pictures actually taken on the Abyssinian expedition of 1869, and you can see the British tents. Unforgiving territory. Harsh terrain. I mean, imagine walking across this kind of terrain. 400 miles. British soldiers on the march, officers and their tents. These are all actual photographs of the expedition 1869. And you can only just imagine the conditions that they had to work in. This is right in front of Magdala. The troops lined up, and not much to hide behind. It's not much cover and not much shade, as you can see. Very harsh, unforgiving terrain, and those rocks can hide a lot of enemy. One of the fortresses they had to storm. You can see the huts of the people and the tents of the British. This was Theodora's hut. That was the king's main palace on this mountain outcrop at the final keep, you could say, of the fortress at Magdala, the entrance to Magdala. And incredibly, no British soldiers died in the final assault either. 2 days later, Magdala was blown up by the engineers. 18th of April 1868, the British Expeditionary Force started back to the coast. And young Stanley wrote, and thus, the modern crusade began numbered with past events to be remembered of all men in all lands amongst the most wonderfully successful campaigns ever conducted in history. It sounds a bit extravagant, but just consider and compare this expedition with what modern governments do and the incredible phenomenal mess they make, and how many people have to die, and how many cities have to be bombed, and how long, and how many billions it costs. These people had a job to do. They went and they did the job and they came back. It was all over in a matter of months, and that's with elephants, mules and camels. I mean, they didn't even have modern equipment, and yet they did it quickly, swiftly, efficiently. And nobody messed around with British consuls or citizens after that. Well, when Stanley...
There were no civilians either.
they weren't attacking civilians. That also is a very nice exception, because it's absolute pain these days how civilians seem to be the main targets of many of these outrageous wars. Absolutely scandalous, like bombing of cities. And, I mean, how do you justify that? Well, Stanley arrived in Suez, and he had his story wired to London, and then on to the New York Herald, and it was the first news story of the campaign to be published, and it established his reputation worldwide. The British didn't even have their war correspondence reports yet, and Stanley got the scoop, and this established his reputation worldwide. Without this scoop, he had never been given the task to seek for Livingstone. It was the Abyssinian campaign that established his reputation. Well, next rebellion, Spain, but from there he was tasked to find the great African explorer and missionary David Livingstone. No word had been heard of Livingstone since he last entered the Dark Continent years before on what became known as his third missionary journey. Well, Stanley loved books, he loved duty, he loved action. He said that he loved action, but he loved books as well. By intense application to duty, by self-denial, he said, I drove myself that I might do my duty thoroughly. Stern duty commands me. Most people have accomplished strenuous and great things, have had very extreme experiences of hardship that have dealt with them. And this man, you could say, I'm sure psychologists have been examining Stanley for a long time, because his abuse that he experienced as a child, and you wonder what that could have done. But by God's grace and through the Bible, he was channeled somewhat later. Stanley came through the fires determined to succeed no matter what the cost, no matter what the odds. He had a tenacious, insatiable desire to succeed no matter what. He had a quick mind, retentive memory. He learned languages. That languages came to him easily. He taught himself French, Swahili, Arabic, and dozens of African dialects. And then he received the most extraordinary assignment ever entrusted to a newspaper reporter from James Gordon Bennett, who, by the way, had just been involved in a monumental scandal. Not that he was involved in the scandal, but he exposed the scandal, which went right up to the President of the United States, President Grant, who his main supporters and others had been involved in a hideous scandal of defrauding people by the millions and making some people phenomenally rich. And at the expense of others, manipulating the markets, basically. And his paper published the report, and he knew he would be in trouble, so he fled to Paris while the American government was looking for heads to roll. And so in Paris, he's looking for something to distract the people, because he knows his life's on the line, he's in deep trouble, because he's blown the whistle on his own government, and his government's furious, because the Grant administration was phenomenally corrupt, actually. And what happened was, he's sitting in Paris, midnight, he calls for Stanley. Stanley's called from Spain, and Stanley knows that this James Gordon Bennett is a tyrant, he's a dictator, he's a phenomenally erratic man. You just don't know which side the bed he gets out of today. And he'd fire people for next to no reason. Lots of people got fired around him. He gets summoned from the war in Spain to Paris, and at midnight, he's asked to go into the bedroom there, and there's this palatial bedroom, this top suite in a grand hotel in Paris, and he identifies himself as Henry Morton Stanley, and Bennett gets out of bed, puts on a dressing gown, and starts to rattle off. You've got to go and cover the Suez Canal, proceed up the Nile, find out about Sir Baker's Column, which is also trying to find Livingstone and end the slave trade there and so on. Write about him, go to Jerusalem, cover the holy places, go to Constantinople, visit the Crimea, the old battle sites, Caucasian mountains, Baghdad, Persepolis, write some articles about that, send articles from India, then go to Zanzibar, from there go and find Dr. David Livingstone. Why? He wants a whole lot of foreign articles. He wants to build up Stanley's name. He wants to get anticipation building up to the scoop of the century, as he calls it, which is finding the greatest explorer of all time, David Livingstone. Draw £1,000, then draw another £1,000, carry on, but find Livingstone. All this at midnight in his bedrobe, and Stanley that night declares he would do everything that a human being could possibly do. Beyond that, he would trust God, enable him to do even more. He didn't wait. He didn't go to sleep at night. He immediately got onto the train, headed off to Orient Express, and whirlwind tour of the Middle East, covered the opening of the Suez Canal, Port Said, holy place in Jerusalem, walked the old battlefields of the Crimean War, and on. He even had time to scratch his name on some of the ruins at the palace in Persepolis where Queen Esther was once ruling. Then off to Zanzibar in Africa. During this time, he's reading everything he can on Livingstone. Livingstone's books, other explorers. He's reading Speke's books. He's reading Burton's books. He's reading anybody who's been in Africa, Baker, the lot. Now, amazingly, despite the tremendous discoveries of David Livingstone, the vast interior of the continent was still mostly unknown at this stage. Most mountains, most lakes, rivers, and forests were still unexplored. Look at some of these old maps of Africa. Okay, this looks pretty embarrassing. That was a map of Africa at one time. This one isn't much better. And then, you see, they thought India and Ethiopia were basically the same place. You know, just like, that's how bad it was. And these were maps. How do you like this? Unknown. Mountains of the moon. That's where the source of the Nile is, and that sort of thing. These were maps. Believe it or not. People thought that this would pass as maps. These are early maps of Africa. And how do you like this one? It looks like some preschooler did this. And even more. That's why if you go to the Kruger National Park, you find the Nile crocodile. They thought, oh, the Nile must be flowing. That's why you've got Tiger Valley. We don't have tigers in Africa, by the way. They thought leopards were tigers. So some pretty poor understanding of geography at this stage. Most of the tribes inhabiting the interior of Africa were unknown. Many maps at the time had words like unknown. Look at that. Just blank and unknown. Unknown parts. Unexplored territory. Written across huge sections of the interior of Africa. Stanley quickly discovered as he landed in Zanzibar that slaves and ivory were the primary product of Africa being exported out of the interior by unscrupulous Arab traders. And here are pictures of unscrupulous Arabs and Europeans involved in this ivory trade. You see, ivory and slaves went together. They'd shoot the elephants and they'd capture the slaves and the slaves would carry the ivory to the coast. Slaves and ivory, the twin evils on which so much of the Middle East was built. Absolutely heinous evils. Slave market in Zanzibar. And you can see more of this documented. The weighing of the tusks, of course, the weight is what determined the price. We do not have 2% as many animals in Africa now as there were in the year 1900 in Africa. The killing of the elephants has been particularly outrageous. The Arabs in Zanzibar seem to regard Africa as a source of seemingly unlimited numbers of slaves and elephant tusks. Well, in 1856, Richard Burton and John Hanning Speke had set out from Zanzibar to find a source of Nile, and this is what happened to John Hanning Speke and Richard Burton as they were running from some Somali tribe that was assegaying them. And when Burton fell sick, Speke set out on his own, discovered what he called Lake Victoria as the source of the Nile. Now, because Burton hadn't been with him, Burton became Speke's bitter enemy and disputed his findings. And therefore, Speke set out with another explorer, James Grant, in 1860 to confirm that Lake Victoria was indeed the source of the Nile, had the right equipment because all the others had been stolen and broken on a previous expedition. They couldn't actually record the exact heights and so on. Now they could. Well, Burton, Speke, Grant, Baker, all of them had established great reputations as African explorers of note. But the explorer that surpassed all of them was the Scottish missionary Dr. David Livingstone. For 20 years, Livingstone had walked across Africa from coast to coast, crossing the Kalahari Desert, discovering Lake Ngami, Victoria Falls, one of the greatest falls in the world, Lake Malawi, many other previously unknown features of the continent. Livingstone was a tireless crusader against the slave trade. At 52 years, he left England for the last time. Starting from Zanzibar, he went up the Rovuma River, which is the border of Tanzania and Mozambique today, explored Lake Malawi, which he wondered if that could be a source of the Nile. It wasn't. And December 1866, some deserters from his porters returned to Zanzibar with news that Livingstone was dead, to justify their desertion. The world mourned his passing, but some doubted the reports. But when letters from Livingstone dated February 1867 and July 1868 were brought out of the interior, it was clear that these deserters had lied. and Livingston was alive, and this created a sensation. And so George Gordon Bent believed that if he could get an interview with this missionary explorer, it would be the scoop of the century. It would be one of the greatest journalistic coups. This is tremendous interest in Livingston and his achievements. Now, Henry Morton Stanley was only 29 years old when he began his expedition to find Livingston. He had never before led or even organized an expedition. He had never been a leader of men, he had never been an employer of men. But he had wide reading. He had varied experiences. He was widely traveled. All of this seems to have prepared him for the challenge. It cost $20,000 to finance this expedition. And let me remind you that a dollar back then would be worth about 200 times that today. Basically, 1 cent in 1900 was worth more than $1 in 1990. So if you want to take 1870s and you want to go through to 2011, I estimate that it's somewhere half a cent back then in 1872 would be worth a dollar today in terms of buying power. $20,000. You multiply that by 200 and you've roughly got the cost of this expedition. James Gordon Bennett was extravagant and he spared no expenses. And Stanley, looking at how all the other explorers had gone, he didn't just get enough for his expedition, he wanted to get double because he wanted to resupply Livingston. If Bennett wanted to pay for this, let him do it. So he went in with a greater goal. And he is wise. He found the Africans who had served the previous explorers like Burton, Speke and Grant, including the famous Bombay and Mubaruki. And he purchased donkeys and boats and tents and vast quantities of ammunition, arms, clothing, medicine, food. He packed the supplies and bales, and he had to have provisions for at least 2 years. 30 kilograms of weight, everything had to be packed into. And because they all had to be carried. 6 tons of material need to be carried into the interior. Now, of course, they couldn't carry enough food to last 2 years. So what they're carrying is beads, coiled cloth to barter for food for local villagers. And they needed it to also pay the customs fees, so to speak, for crossing the different territories of the chiefs. He got 2 other white men, 23 askaris, that's like soldiers, 157 pagazis, those are carriers, porters, and a whole lot of others, 192 men in total. And this was their load. He went with shotgun, carbines, rifles, pistols, flintlock muskets, swords, daggers, axes, hatchets, long knives. And they went through arid, rough savanna, hot and humid climate, temperatures going up to 128 degrees Fahrenheit. Then as the rainy seasons came, the river swelled, animals and men bogged down marsh. They crossed one marsh that was 45 miles of black, swampy, sinking down up to the knees, up to the waist in mud, climbing through this mud, and just parasites, disease, leeches, bilharzia, you name it, tsetse flies, mosquitoes, every kind of insect afflicted the men and the animals of the column. 13 months of this expedition, Stanley was laid low by fever 23 times. Dysentery, smallpox, malaria, unknown fevers afflicted everyone on the expedition. And the first casualty was one of the white team members, William Farquhar, who died very early in the expedition. Elephantitis. His legs just swelled and swelled and swelled, and he finally died. Every day presented new problems to be solved, and Stanley had to learn leadership on the march. How to organize, how to discipline, how to motivate, how to resolve conflicts, and how to communicate well. Many of the men deserted, stealing or losing the goods they were carrying. It was a never-ending struggle to keep the column together and to keep them moving forwards. Every chief demanded tribute for the travelers to pass through the territory. Yet, despite a lot of frustrations and delays and his inexperience, Stanley's column achieved a rapid advance twice the speed of Burton and Speke's columns, and they were meant to be extremely experienced African explorers. So Burton and Speke, who were considered the fastest up to then, Stanley doubled their speed. There was a battle at Marumbo. Most of the men became so frightened, it was a war with Arab slave traders, and they refused to go any further. The other white man on Expedition Shaw became so demoralized, he became worthless at this point. Many men deserted, and mutiny erupted. This is Stanley's shotgun. He loaded both barrels of his shotgun, adjusted his revolvers for ready action, walked straight towards the rebellious men who had picked up muskets in a threatening way. He raised the shotgun, aimed it directly at the heads, and commanded them instantly to drop their weapons. When one man, Asmani, refused, Stanley knocked him to the ground and in this way quelled the rebellion. He then compelled the men to swear a solemn oath to remain faithful to him for the rest of the journey until they found Livingstone. Here's the gravestone marker for William Shaw, who died on the Livingstone search expedition 1871. That's how it looks today. That was brought back later and put up. They had a much more temporary marker at the time. Then they met a native caravan coming from Ujiji, who spoke about a white man with grey hair who had just arrived at Ujiji. Was he ever at Ujiji before? Yes. He went away a long time ago. The timing. Stanley was overwhelmed with excitement and impatience. He pulled out his new flannel suit, he had his Wellington boots, polished his helmet, chalked. He folded a fresh pagi around it. And on 10th of November 1871, on the 236th day of his expedition, he ordered the American flag unfurled and had muskets fired to announce their arrival. Susie and Chuma, the faithful servants of Livingstone who he had rescued from slave raiders, met them on the path, ran back to inform David Livingstone that a white man with a strange flag was coming to see them. As the only two white men in all of Equatorial Africa from the Zambezi to the Nile met in the center of Africa on the shores of Lake Tanganyika, Stanley walked deliberately towards the older man, raised his hat and said, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume." And Stanley smiled and said, "Yes." Livingstone smiled and said, "Yes." And then Stanley shook hands, declaring, "I thank God, Doctor, that I've been permitted to see you." And Livingstone replied, "I feel thankful that I'm here to welcome you." And that was the extent of the emotion expressed on this occasion. Can you imagine? He then offered a whole lot of letters from friends and family at home. Livingstone put them on side and said, "Years waiting for letters has taught me to be patient. I can wait a few hours longer. Tell me the general news in the world." Well, you asked the right person. Stanley is a journalist. Suez Canal has been opened. General Grant's now president of the United States. The Pacific Railroad across the continent of America has been completed. The Spanish Revolution has driven Queen Isabella from the throne. Prussia has defeated Denmark and France. Emperor Napoleon III is out. The first transatlantic cable has been laid. You can have instant communication between North America and Europe by underground cable. Can you imagine? From his side, Livingstone reported that Henry Morton Stanley had arrived at the most opportune time. Arab slavers had robbed him of all his supplies, and he was in a desperate, sick, and destitute situation. Just think about that. This expedition had been set in motion years before, but God arranged things that Livingstone's prayers were answered at the very moment he needed them. Even though things had been set in motion long before, he would be at that point. But Stanley arrived at the right time. Livingstone was absolutely at the end. I mean, he had nothing. Not a drop of quinine, not any kind of medicine, no food. He was in rags. He didn't even have shoes on. Well, their relationship deepened. And Stanley reported how impressed, surprised, captivated he was by the courtesy and dignity and patience and high morals of Dr. David Livingstone. He wrote of him, "He is lowly of heart, meek in speech, merciful of heart, pure in mind, peaceful in act, during health or sickness. He was consistently noble, upright, pious, manly in all the days of my companionship with him." Livingstone's patience and perseverance impressed Stanley the most. Of course, Stanley needed perseverance. He had always run away from his problems. And he felt convicted about the fact that up till then he had always tended to solve his problems by running away from them. But now he had succeeded in facing his difficulties. He overcame them. And Stanley determined, "I will never again run away from anything." Again explains what he achieved in the Congo later. Together, Livingstone and Stanley undertook an expedition by boat around the northern end of Lake Tanganyika, thinking, could this be the source of the Nile? They ruled that out, but it was a nice idea anyway. Finally, when Stanley had to return, Livingstone trusted him with a box filled with his letters, his diaries, his scientific and geographic research, many other papers. 14th of March, 1872, they parted, and this woodcut depicts the scene of this parting. Stanley later said, "Livingstone was the father I never had." In fact, when he heard people criticizing David Livingstone as the lost explorer who'd never had a convert, Stanley said, "That's a lie. Livingstone was never lost. He knew exactly where he was. It's that we didn't know where he was. He wasn't lost. He was still trying to find the source of the Nile. He was reaching people, the gospel. He's fighting the slave trade. Livingstone wasn't lost." And he said, "And I'm one of his converts," which is an interesting comment. After resupplying Livingstone with all the trading goods he could need, Stanley's column had much less to transport back to the coast, so they made very good time. And here you can see their march from Ujiji all the way through to Bagamoyo. Bagamoyo means where the heart is crushed. That was the slave terminus of the Arabs. That's where they sent off millions of slaves through the centuries. So Bagamoyo, where the heart is crushed, that's the name that the African people gave it. In just 54 days after leaving Tabora, they reached Bagamoyo on the coast. And there they met the tardily sent out Livingstone Search and Relief expedition under Lieutenant William Henn of the Royal Navy. When they discovered that Livingstone had been discovered and resupplied, they gave up, went back home. They didn't even start. Stanley had walked 2,250 miles in 411 days. An incredible expedition. 20 people died in that expedition. Now, if you think that's bad, wait till we get to the Congo. Here you can see Livingstone's path, the dots around Lake Malawi, and then going up to Ujiji and where he was found in Ujiji. So that gives you an idea of that particular path. Then Livingstone tried another expedition to the Congo, and he finally ended up dying at Chitambo's village in Zambia, what today is northern Zambia. Stanley was completely unprepared for the responses he had received in Europe. Condemned as an imposter. "Ah, he's never even been to Africa," some said. Others hailed him in the most extravagant ways, comparing him with Hannibal's march through the Alps and Napoleon's march through the Alps. People in England were intensely interested and excited, but the Standard and the Spectator said they didn't think the reports were genuine. Some claimed that he was a complete fraud. Sensational stories, speculations abounded, people dug into his background, came up with illegitimate birth, not even an American, and scandals all over the place. Suspicions, sudden fame, unexpected vicious attacks upon his character, and worst of all, unfair attacks on David Livingstone. All of this disillusioned Stanley and made him just want to recoil from human company even more. Stanley wrote that his belief that toil, generosity, devotion to duty, righteous living would receive recognition at the hands of my fellow creatures, but this was shattered. However, when Livingstone's family confirmed beyond question the authenticity of the letters and papers that Stanley had brought back, all charge of forgery were withdrawn. The Times, the Daily News, the Daily Telegraph Punch declared Stanley is a true hero. Lord Granville, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, presented Stanley with a gold box with 5 dozen diamonds as a gift from Her Majesty Queen Victoria, in recognition of the prudence and zeal displayed by him in opening communication with Dr. Livingstone. Can you imagine, even brought out notes in honour of David Livingstone. And Stanley was later received by Queen Victoria herself. He was honoured by the Royal Geographic Society that initially had condemned him. He was offered public apology. He was given the Victoria Medal. Scotland made him an honorary citizen and awarded him more medals. And then in just 3 months after returning to Europe, he published How I Found Livingstone Stanley in Central Africa. And this achieved bestseller status very quickly. He received a flood of letters from strangers, relatives, acquaintances from his early years, who were suddenly affectionate towards this orphan that they had spurned at one time. As they say, success has many parents, but failure is an orphan. Even Saint Asaph puts up this memorial to Stanley in the place where he was once whipped and beaten. He sailed into New York, and Stanley was received with great fanfare, a warm welcome by the entire staff of the Herald. The only person missing from the welcome was the proprietor, James Gordon Bennett, the one who'd actually sent Stanley to Africa. By the way, this is his adoptive son from Africa, someone he rescued from a slave trader, Kalula, who travelled with him everywhere. Well, to James Gordon Bennett, his reporter's fame provoked a deep displeasure, which developed into a jealousy and later a hatred, as Stanley returned from even greater expeditions and achieved even greater exploits. And this hatred lasted as long as Stanley lived. Bennett did not like to share the glory. Receptions, banquets, cheers, applause resounded throughout Stanley's triumphal procession throughout the United States. And David Livingstone's elder brother came from Canada to New York to thank Stanley personally for what he had done for his brother. Author Mark Twain praised Stanley extravagantly, even comparing him with Christopher Columbus. He said, Columbus was not looking for America. He found it by accident. America's a big continent. He was on his way to find Asia. And he thought he'd found Asia, but actually he'd found America, and who could have missed it when he sailed west? But he said, but Stanley went into a huge continent and looked for a single man and found him. He said, that is a great achievement. Interesting point. Well, next thing, Bennett sent Stanley to cover the war in Spain. And Stanley said, this is a relief from the round of banquets and lectures and receptions, honors and controversy and criticism, which came at him relentlessly since his return from Africa. Of course, people dug out the fact that he had deserted the Navy, that he had changed sides and all. So he had all this control, and he had enough of it. He just wanted to retreat back into some war somewhere. Then England embarked another military expedition to Africa, this time to punish the Ashantis, who had massacred 600 British citizens. Ashanti land is roughly where Ghana is today. Major General Sir Garnet Wolseley was in command of this expedition to what is today Ghana. Sir Garnet Wolseley was a very good friend of General Charles Gordon, and Garnet Wolseley, remember, was involved in the Anglo-Zulu War at the very end and at the beginning of the Anglo-Boer War, the First Anglo-Boer War, and he was also involved in Sudan, the attempted relief of Gordon, which failed. Garnet Wolseley later became the Chief of Staff of the whole British military, very accomplished British gentleman. The year was 1873. Stanley wrote, the people are as barbarous, untutored, and superstitious, as wild in appearance, as naked in body, as filthy in habits, as any tribe of savages I've ever seen. You couldn't imagine that being written today, but you could say that in quite a few inner cities. If you went into New York or Paris, you'd see people just like that today, but this is not politically correct talk. Stanley described the grisly march, encountering human sacrifices and severed heads on poles in every village they passed through. This is what today would be Ghana. At Kumasi, Stanley located the killing fields of King Kofi of the Shanti. It was a sacred grove where prisoners and slaves were sacrificed. The terrible stench of decomposing corpses was overwhelming. 30 or more decapitated bodies in the last stage of decomposition were immediately visible. Skulls were piled so high, Stanley calculated the grave contained the skulls of over 120,000 people. The British Army fought three battles against the Ashanti, but while nothing in Stanley's account of the expedition indicates that he took any personal share in the fighting, Lord Wolseley's memoirs describes Henry Stanley in this very enlightening quote. A thoroughly good man, no noise, no danger ruffled his nerve, and he looked as cool and self-possessed as if he had been at target practice. Time after time, as I turned in his direction, I saw him go down to a kneeling position to steady his rifle as he applied the most daring of the enemy with a never-failing aim. The close-shut lips, the determined expression of his manly face, told plainly no danger could appall. The cool, unflinching manliness gave fresh courage. I had been previously somewhat prejudiced against him, but all such feelings were slain and buried at Amoful. Ever since, I've been proud to reckon amongst the bravest of my brave colleagues. Now, he's an American and he's a journalist, so he had two strikes against him right from the beginning. But Garnet Wolseley's prejudice against him were swept aside when he saw how he behaved under fire. Here's the British Ashanti expedition coming back and being received to a warm welcome in Victorian England. Stanley published his account of the British military campaigns in Abyssinia and Ashanti under a single book, the title Kumasi and Magdala. It was while returning from the Ashanti War that Stanley heard of the death of Dr. David Livingstone, and he wrote, Dear Livingstone, another sacrifice for Africa. His mission, however, must not be allowed to cease. Others must go forward and fill the gap. May I be selected to succeed him in opening up Africa to the light of Christianity. May Livingstone's God be my God. May God direct me as he wills. I can only vow to be obedient and not to slacken. The slave trade in Africa had been well exposed by Livingstone. Hideous slavery. Something in the region of 90% of the slaves captured in the interior never even reached the coast alive. Something like 2 million people a century were being enslaved in Central Africa. Stanley saw Africa as a challenge. Livingstone was his example and his inspiration. Stanley dedicated his life to serving Africa by developing Christianity and civilization throughout its vast and unexplored interior. On the 18th of April, 1874, Henry Morton Stanley was one of the pallbearers for the funeral of Dr. David Livingstone at Westminster Abbey. Stanley was given a foremost position on the right, and Susie on the left. And so, that's the most honoured position of all. Shortly after that, the Daily Telegraph of London and the New York Herald united to fund an expedition to Central Africa under the leadership of Henry Morton Stanley to complete the work left unfinished by the lamentable death of Dr. Livingstone, to solve, if possible, the remaining problems of the geography of Central Africa, to investigate and report upon the haunts of human traders. 15th August, 1874, Stanley and three volunteers set sail from England to Zanzibar. He sought the men who had served him on the Livingstone search expedition, or had served with Livingstone, ultimately selected 356 carriers and soldiers. 12th of November, loaded with animal supplies, they set sail for Bagamoyo on the coast of East Africa. Immediately, Stanley had to deal with those of his men who began stealing and assaulting the local inhabitants because they had weapons and money. Then when he found that some had kidnapped women, he forced them to set them free, and he then faced down a mutiny from the people who were upset that he is sending these women back to their homes. There were desertions. They passed through areas of severe famine. The guides deserted. New guides got them lost. Not a good beginning. January 1875 began with a series of severe hardships, catastrophes. Men died from the heat, from lack of food, from exhaustion. Local inhabitants were hostile. Severely overcharged the expedition, four times more than the going rate for food. Sickness plagued the men. In the first 2 months, 20 people died and 89 deserted. That's just one third the expedition. They've barely started and they've got nowhere. Then the Uturu natives attacked the expedition. In just one battle, the expedition lost 21 askaris in one fight. When Stanley reached Lake Victoria, he called on volunteers to man the boat, the Lady Alice. Not one step forward. The men declared they were cowards on the water. Thereafter, Stanley dispensed with asking for volunteers, and he just selected and ordered his men. Beginning on the 8th of March, 1875, Stanley explored Lake Victoria, and he established it as the largest lake in Africa, covering 26,000 square miles. He sailed along and mapped its 2,000 miles of shoreline, recording every cove, river, island connected with it. He frequently faced savages, drunk, screaming their intention to kill him, but his calm and confident demeanor frequently prevented conflict. In April, he met with Mutesa, the Kabaka, or the King of Uganda, or the Bagandans, as they called him. John Hanning Speke had written of Mutesa very positively. And Mutesa claimed to be a Muslim, having been converted to Islam by an Arab. So Stanley determined to destroy his belief in Islam and to teach him the doctrines of Christ. For 12 days, Stanley instructed the king from the Old and the New Testaments, and at the end, Mutesa announced that he had followed the Christian Sabbath. He had instructed the Ten Commandments to be written on a board where everyone could see and study them every day. But he would be a Muslim as well. Mutesa loaned Stanley canoes and men to explore the western shores of Lake Victoria. Colonel Lenant de Belfonce was then sent out by General Charles Gordon, governor of Sudan, to establish communications with Uganda. Stanley entrusted him with a letter to the Daily Telegraph appealing for missionaries to be sent out to Uganda. De Belfonce was murdered in Sudan, but Stanley's letter was found discovered concealed in his boot later. And when they eventually found the way to England, they were published by the Telegraph, and a huge fund was collected, and missionaries were sent out from Uganda, sent out from England to Uganda, and Christianity flourished in Uganda as a result. Later, Stanley was confronted by hundreds of well-armed warriors in war costume. Only the protection of Mutesa prevented a fight on this occasion. Later they discovered half-decomposed bodies with axe wounds, and then Matisse's escort of canoes deserted Stanley. Within days, the expedition came under sustained attack, and Stanley wrote of a scene of rampant wildness and hideous verbosity beyond description, as his boat was surrounded by a forest of spears and over 50 bows were bent nearly double with leveled arrows leveled at him. Over 200 stalwart demons, as he described them, contended as to who would deliver the first blow. Stanley had to fight his way out of this desperate situation with his Winchester repeater rifle and a shotgun. And as they sought to row to safety, war canoes pursued them. With his elephant rifle, Stanley sunk boat after boat to their pursuers. His elephant rifle could knock the bottom right out of a wooden canoe. For over 76 hours, they were without any food before finding refuge. They didn't dare go onto the banks because it was just too dangerous. Upon completing the circumnavigation of Lake Victoria, they were welcomed back to the base camp, only to discover that none of the Europeans had died, and many more of the expedition were suffering from dysentery. Attacks of fever reduced Stanley to a mere 108 pounds in weight. As they attempted to progress further into Congo, several of the canoes proved to be rotten and sank. In all, the expedition lost 5 canoes, a case of ammunition, 1,200 pounds of grain, and 5 guns. Disastrous. The treacherous Bulbira attacked the party and killed a number of men. Stanley launched a counterattack. Then Matisse asked for Stanley's support in dealing with the rebellious Wavuma tribe. And by innovation and audacity, Stanley intimidated the Wavuma by strapping a whole lot of canoes together, and he built a great impressive tower and came before them and said he'll unleash fire on them unless they surrendered. And without any bloodshed, he compelled the Wavuma to surrender. He then persuaded Matisse and his whole court to completely convert to Christianity and not try and be on both camps. Matisse gave him an army of 2,000 warriors to escort them to Lake Edward. After Stanley marched through to Lake Tanganyika, completed the circumnavigation of the whole lake in 51 days, proved it was the longest freshwater lake in the world. Now Stanley had been in Africa for 2 years. He had accomplished 2 great geographical objectives, exploring and mapping both Lake Victoria, the largest lake, and Lake Tanganyika, the longest lake. Now he prepared for the most audacious fall, the exploration of the Congo River. At this point, Stanley had already accomplished much. He could have returned home with great honors. He's now accomplished even more than Speke and Burton. But the fascination of the unexplored Lualaba River drew him. Was it part of the Congo River? Was part of the Niger? Was part of the Nile River? At its height, it could be the source of Nile. It was high enough. It's so big that it must enter into a sea, and we know all the rivers that enter the sea, so it's got to be one of those 3. So no explorer dared enter into the notorious cannibal country of the Congo. Stanley was convinced that this fast-flowing river must empty into the sea. It had to be one of those 3. He thought that exploring the Lualaba River was what Livingstone would have wanted him to do, but he didn't have a single canoe to supplement the Lady Alice. He would have to supplement his expedition with a force strong enough to give him a fighting chance of succeeding. To do so, he'd have to deal with Hamet bin Mohammed, known as Tibu Tip, a notorious slave trader. Tibu Tip was shrewd, unscrupulous, ruthless, and cruel. His slave raiders had killed many thousands, enslaved countless more. Tibu Tip and 700 of his men gave confidence to Stanley's expedition, who threatened to mutiny rather than go down the dreaded Heart of Darkness River. This was shaking hands with the devil, and no doubt his most controversial decision. So on the 5th of November 1876, Stanley marched out of Nyangwe at the head of an expedition of nearly 1,000. By the second day, they were hacking their way through dense, thick jungle, which made every step painful. After a week of marching, they'd covered only 40 miles. They came across massive boa constrictors in the forest, like this one. They marched in places where you couldn't believe how big the trees were and how high, going 200 feet up where you couldn't even see the sunlight. It was so dense. Now, the Lady Alice was like this ship. It was carried in sections and assembled when they got to the river. The terrain became even more dense and difficult as the jungle shut out every ray of sunlight. When they finally reached the Lualaba River, the Lady Alice was assembled. And while Stanley and his crew went by sea, by river, Tip-a-Tip and the bulk of the expedition continued parallel on the land. Every village they passed seemed eerily empty. The inhabitants had apparently fled. But the row of skulls lining the streets and the human bones littering the huts and yards spoke eloquently of the depraved nature of the inhabitants. Where the Ruiki River empties into the Congo River, Stanley's path was blocked by war canoes filled with what he described as hostile savages, who poured spears and arrows into his people. As Stanley fired back, the attackers fled. Smallpox broke out amongst the expedition, and soon they had buried 12 of their number. And when they discovered that the cannibals dug up the bodies and ate them, they began the practice of burial in the river. When they came across 6 old broken abandoned canoes, they repaired them and used these to transport the sick and wounded on the river. Rapids overturned one of these canoes. 4 precious Snyder rifles were lost. Despite difficulties on land and river, sickness and hostile attacks, the expedition pushed on, and Tippu-Tip and others pleaded with Stanley to turn back before it was too late, but Stanley was determined. He was always determined. He wouldn't give up. At Vinya Najara, on the 18th of December, the expedition came under sustained attack. They constructed a barricade of logs and bush, beat off the savage attacks time and again. The yells of their attackers and the booming of their war horns, the crack of the rifles, the muskets, the screams of the wounded created an unnerving, chaotic din. For 2 hours they fought desperately before the attackers fled. Poisoned arrows continued to drop into the camp throughout the night. Sleep seemed impossible. But even under those conditions, many of the exhausted men dozed on and off. The next morning, Stanley set out in the Lady Alice to scout the area and discovered a series of villages only a quarter of a mile down the river. He decided to capture the nearest village of his attackers. And seizing it, he fortified it and beat off several wild, determined attacks. A mass of arrows flowed into the village from the jungle. 800 men war canoes attempted to rush him simultaneous from the land attack. He beat off both land and river attacks, and Stanley determined to make a night attack and take their canoes. Very bold. This would not only deprive the attackers of their mobility, but enable his expedition to all travel on the river, which would be safer. That night, under cover of darkness, they cut loose 8 long canoes from one encampment, 26 canoes from another. Some of these canoes were 50 feet long. By 5 in the morning, they were all safely back in camp with 38 liberated canoes. At sunrise, they could hear the cries of rage from the savages who had been deprived of their most cherished possessions, their canoes. Now they were ready to accept Stanley's offers of peace terms. Stanley returned 15 of their canoes and paid them what he considered a fair price for the ones that he kept. He also released their prisoners. However, at this point, Tippu-Tip decided he had had enough. He and his followers would go no further. They determined to return east. He had also taken back all of the sick and wounded, which was actually a good thing. And now that Stanley had 23 canoes, he felt he could survive on his own, so he didn't mind seeing Tippu-Tip leave at this point. He then made a speech to inspire his expedition. Into whatever sea this great river empties, there we shall follow it. You have seen that I have saved you a score of times when everything looked dark and dismal for us. If I risk your life, I risk mine. It may be we shall meet 100 wild tribes who yet, for the sake of eating us, will rush to fight us. We have no wish to molest them. If they fight us, we must accept it as an evil, like disease, which we cannot help. If we fight on our own, for our own lives. We shall continue our journey that we shall toil on and on by this great river and to the salt sea. Stanley then declared a 3-day holiday in honor of Christmas 1876. There was feasting, there was dancing, there were canoe races. Each of the captured canoes were given names like Livingston and Herald and Telegraph and Mattesa. And the entire expedition was on a river and they raced forwards. Soon drums and war horns warned of imminent attack. Eager young warriors with painted bodies and grotesquely adorned with skins of wild animals screamed, "Meat, meat," as they massed for attack. Stanley wrote that it must have appeared that they were a herd of ownerless cattle straying amongst the starving. He described the attackers as the living embodiment of hatred. In order to protect his people, Stanley instructed his men to collect shields after every battle, and they were using these shields to bulwark their canoes, making them look something like the galleys of the ancient Vikings to protect them from spears and arrows. At this stage, all distinctions between pagazis, carriers, and askari, soldiers, had vanished. Every man both rode and fought. Those who didn't have guns captured spears and threw them back at the next hostile tribe that attacked. At one point, the expedition was attacked from both sides of the river at the same time. The attackers were painted half white, half red, with broad black stripes. One war canoe was 85 feet long. As they targeted the Lady Alice, Stanley had his men fire volley into the attackers. And as the survivors leapt overboard, this massive canoe was captured, incorporated into the expedition's transport. They called it the Crocodile. Amidst the pounding of the drums, the screaming of the attackers, the noise of battle, came the ominous roar of a waterfall ahead. Attacked from both sides and with obviously high waterfall ahead of them, they were faced with a dilemma: drowning or being eaten by cannibals. Stanley determined to establish a beachhead and fight. They built a stockade and fought until sunset and through the night. Stanley then scouted ahead and established this was only the first of a series of cataracts. Today, the seven cataracts are called Stanley Falls. It took a month of hard fighting to carry their canoes and kit past each of the waterfalls, fighting off hostile attacks in the dense jungle. And by a series of bold attacks and outflanking maneuvers, Stanley required his men to sometimes be fighting 72 hours straight without respite. At one point, Stanley surprised the attackers by capturing their village and holding their chief hostage until peace was established with that tribe. Stanley described the Iron Age culture in the Congo at this time. Baskets, fishnets, bundles of wooden spears with iron points, human skulls ornamenting the village streets, human ribs, thigh bones, vertebrae lay scattered around the huts. At one point, they found themselves surrounded by a huge net and a mass of men with spears hunting them like game. Sometimes the path had sharp pointed traps designed to injure or cripple them if they stepped on these. The prisoners they captured had teeth filed, sharpened teeth, the sharpened teeth of cannibals, ugly rows of tattoo marks on their foreheads. They learnt that when these cannibals were unable to capture strangers, they just ate their own old men and women. Attacks came thick and fast, sometimes with such intensity in such huge numbers that had they not been prepared, they would have been overwhelmed. Savage screams filled the jungle and the drums were seldom silent. Finally, after a torturous month, the seventh and last waterfall was bypassed, and with the Congo River a mile wide, they relaunched their boats at the bottom of the Seven Cataracts Stanley Falls. There was tremendous exhilaration amongst the expeditioners. They felt that the worst was surely behind them, but they soon were to learn that the worst was still ahead of them. Attacks increased in intensity. Poison arrows were shot at them at any time, day or night. They felt like hunted animals. Stanley rose to the occasion, clear-headed and calm in battle, confident that God was protecting him, and he was destined to complete his mission of ending the slave trade in Africa. By now, his men had been hardened into by both travel and conflict, united into an effective fighting force and an efficient team. After a long series of battles and skirmishes, they faced one of the most desperate battles on the 1st of February, 1877. Worn by great shouting and thunderous beating of drums, they came around a bend close to where the Aruwi River joins the Congo, and a fleet of gigantic canoes, bigger than anything they'd ever seen before, blocked their way. He formed up his boats in a battle line with the Lady Alice 50 yards ahead, and they confronted 54 battle canoes, the largest canoe at 80 paddlers. And as the monster canoe aimed straight for the Lady Alice, Stanley encouraged his men, "Be firm as I am. Wait until you see the first spear. Take good aim. Do not fire all at once. Keep aiming until you are sure of your man." As the monster canoe discharged a broadside of arrows, Stanley and his men opened fire. The enemy retreated out of range to reform for another attack. Stanley decided to preempt the attack by launching his own attack. In hot pursuit, Stanley's men forced their attackers' withdrawal into a rout. And when the attackers made for shore, Stanley's men pursued them and chased them through the village and into the jungle. At the village, they found a Miskiti temple where a large circular roof was supported by 33 tusks of ivory erected over a huge idol 4 feet high and painted bright red. This was the focus of worship of the Basoko tribe. There are numerous skulls on poles, half-eaten human forearm and ribs on the fire. At this point, the expedition had travelled 340 miles north since leaving Nyangwe. The battle at the Urumi River mouth was the 28th battle in the Congo. 79 men had died on this expedition so far. They were still in the middle of the continent. The exploration of Congo River was not even close to half complete. They still had a very long way to go, but Stanley was determined to never turn back. He kept up all details in his journal, writing, "I persist, trusting events to an all-gracious providence." Storms threatened the canoes with destruction, and a chronic shortage of food threatened starvation. However, at this point, they found friendly natives in the region of Rubanga who were willing to trade food for wire and beads. Like the other tribes encountered in the Congo, these people were elaborately tattooed. They had never seen a white man before, but they had in their possession four antique Portuguese muskets, which they must have traded for slaves. And this greatly disturbed Stanley, as it indicated that he might start encountering hostile tribes armed with muskets. Now, his expedition had only 20 rifles and 20 muskets. This would not be adequate if confronted by a large number of hostiles armed with firearms. The next tribe downriver, the Orangi, were also friendly and willing to trade. So the men of Stanley's expedition began to hope that they were emerging out of the heart of darkness and entering into the outskirts of civilization. However, shortly after this, a shot rang out from the Oranga canoe, and one of Stanley's men from Zanzibar fell dead from a ball fired from a musket. A few days later, on 14th February, the expedition was attacked by the most militant tribe on the Congo, the Bangala. The Bangala were the most brilliantly decorated warriors that they had yet encountered. Their war cries resounded, their canoes advanced towards Stanley's men. Holding cloth in one hand and a coil of brass wire in the other, Stanley offered trade and peace. He was told that the Bangala liked to trade, but actually liked to fight more. The battle continued throughout the afternoon, and Stanley counted 63 war canoes opposing them, each with an average of 5 muskets. That's 300 guns against 40. The Bangala was skillful and aggressive, but after a 5-hour battle, the Bangala retreated. This was Stanley's 31st battle on the Congo. Very few professional soldiers have fought as many battles in a lifetime as Stanley fought in just 4 months. Incredibly, although Stanley was in the forefront of every battle, standing in the prow of the Lady Alice, he came through every battle unscathed. Absolutely incredible. 3 days later, they reached a pool, which they named Stanley Pool. At this point, they had traveled 1,235 miles since leaving Nyangwe on the river. Ahead of them were 32 cataracts. Many canoes were lost, injuries incurred as the boats were laboriously hauled past each cataract. At one point, Stanley fell 30 feet into a chasm, but miraculously escaped with only minor injuries. Their largest canoe, the Crocodile, was soon swept over a waterfall with the loss of 7 men, including his adopted son, Kalulu. This cataract was then called Kalulu Falls. The cataracts and rapids were so numerous the team developed a standard routine for transporting canoes and kit past them. A dangerous whirlpool was only narrowly escaped. When the Lady Alice survived going over a waterfall and somehow remained afloat, this was named the Lady Alice Falls. From 16th of March to 21st of April, the expedition travelled only 34 miles in a painstaking 37 days. At one point, local until then friendly natives advanced in the camp with muskets, spears, poison arrows, and shrill war cries. Stanley asked them, why did they approach in such an aggressive fashion? Their reply was, they'd seen the white man writing in a book. They demanded that he destroy this book, because it was a bad omen. It meant their goats would die. Now, Stanley had filled his journal with invaluable geographical calculations, sketches, details on tribes, languages, villages, and countries. He could not sacrifice the fruit of all their trials and exploration, which many people had actually died for. Nevertheless, he was compelled to agree to burn off the offending book. He went to his tent, pulled out a well-worn edition of Shakespeare. As this was a similar size and the same cover as his journal, the natives didn't realize the switch. They left with satisfaction when the book was burned to ashes. By now, their shoes were well worn through. This was Stanley's shoes at the end of the expedition. And Stanley was the sole remaining European on the expedition. Frank Hancock was reduced to wearing makeshift sandals, and ulcers and sores had developed on the soles of their feet. At another waterfall, last remaining European companion of Stanley was lost. Trying to steer around a treacherous whirlpool, Frank Pocock, the sole surviving European member of this expedition, was lost. Most of the men of the expedition fell into dark despair after this accident. After all the diseases, battles, struggles against nature, heat, exhaustion, strain, the men threatened mutiny. 31 attempted to desert, but the local chiefs would not allow them to pass through their territory. Soon the mutineers had to return, and Stanley attempted to inspire tired, hungry, and discouraged men. The next 3 months they travelled only 3 miles. Another 3 cataracts remained ahead. The tribes were sullen, uncooperative, unwilling to trade any food. All on the expedition were wasting away for lack of nourishment. There were only 116 people left on this expedition, and 40 were seriously ill. As they were apparently only a few miles from Boma, which was on the coast, where there were apparently European settlers, Stanley sent messengers ahead requesting emergency food supplies. 2 days later, this messenger returned with pagazis bearing food and a message of welcome from the Europeans at Boma. This gave them the strength to walk the remaining 3 days. They abandoned the Lady Alice and walked. On the 9th of August, 1877, 999 days after their departure from the coast, from the east coast of Africa, they arrived on the west coast of Africa. Welcome back to civilization by 4 white men who treat them to a banquet in Boma. They were then transported to Cabinda by a steamship, and then a ship carried them to Luanda, where they boarded another ship for Cape Town. And here's Cape Town at about that time. There Stanley was welcomed, and he was honoured in this city while his ship anchored in Table Bay. A British warship then carried him from Cape Town to Zanzibar. Cape Town's a tavern of the seas. It's had many famous people here, from William Carey, David Livingstone, many missionaries, and even Henry Morton Stanley was hosted and honoured in Cape Town at that time. Here's the picture of the survivors of this great expedition back in Zanzibar. Of the 359 people who had left Bagamoyo with Stanley 3 years before, only 82 returned to Zanzibar with him. 58 had been killed in battles with the cannibals in the Congo. 49 had died from smallpox. 9 had starved to death. 14 had drowned. Typhoid, fever, crocodiles, other causes accounted for the rest. Never before nor since had any African expedition accomplished so much in terms of mapping more unknown territory. Stanley had survived and surveyed the Great Lakes of Victoria and Tanganyika and the world's second longest river, the Congo. He had succeeded in exploring and mapping more territory than explorations of Burton, Speke, Grant, Baker, even Livingstone. The political and commercial implications of his geographical discoveries were immense. Stanley was only 37 years old when he completed his expedition from coast to coast, from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, across the heart of Africa. Of all the great explorers, Stanley alone followed up his explorations by developing an empire. This is where he becomes even more controversial. He determined to pour the civilization of Europe into the barbarian of Africa, to use his words. Commerce would be used to bring Christianity and culture to the Congo. Again, his words. He described isolation as the great curse of Central Africa. European missionaries and businessmen needed to open up the great continent to civilization and free the Africans from animism, superstition, slavery, intertribal warfare, and cannibalism. The 1,425,000 square miles of the Congo River Basin were comparable to the Mississippi and the Amazon. The 3,000 miles of the Congo River poured 12 million cubic feet of water into the Atlantic Ocean, he said, every second. It had a tremendous potential for hydroelectric power. Africa could be freed by civilizing the Congo. In January 1878, Stanley was welcomed to Europe by representatives of King Leopold II of the Belgians. King Umberto of Italy sent him an award. The Khedive of Egypt sent him a medal. All the geographic societies of the world awarded Stanley gold medals. The Prince of Wales paid him tribute. Commons throughout Europe and governments honored him. The Congress in the United States passed a unanimous vote of thanks for his achievements. Stanley was now the most famous African explorer alive. Just 4 months after his return, he submitted his manuscript for Through the Dark Continent, which in more than 1,000 pages catalogued his incredible journey, and most of the pictures I've used in this presentation come from an original edition of this book. In November 1878, King Leopold of the Belgians personally requested Stanley to lead a venture to create the Congo Free State. In May 1879, Stanley arrived back at the mouth of the Congo with less than 100 men, determined to bring civilization to millions of the most savage people of Earth, living in one of the world's most remote and inhospitable regions. Incredible. The debilitating furnace-like climate, the dense jungles, the treacherous rivers, the myriad of insects carrying fatal diseases, which most scientists didn't even know about, let alone how to counteract. This didn't seem to dampen the enthusiasm and the vision of Stanley to bring civilization to the Congo. But who could have believed he could have done it? For 5.5 years he labored to achieve this despite overwhelming frustrations. His efforts in the Congo earned him the name Bula Matari, the breaker of rocks. They physically broke rocks to build the roads, the railways and everything else, but I presume he cracked skulls too. Stanley had a reputation amongst his officers as a hard man. But his response was, one is not likely to be hard with persons who perform their duties, but it is difficult to be mild or amiable with people who are absolutely incapable and who will not listen to admonition without blistering with resentment. He was described as a man of iron, a man of courage, a man of dogged will, and a splendid leader. But while he is respectful of the customs, traditions, and beliefs of the Africans, he was considered harsh to his fellow Europeans. As one man said, Stanley had no real friends, but many enemies. However long you might know him, I doubt you will ever become his friend, said one. Stanley could not understand and had little use for those who held their duties more lightly than him. Jim, duty was everything. He did not play cards. He didn't play any game. He only read for recreation. Stanley negotiated over 400 treaties with the once warlike tribes along the Congo River. These became the foundations of the Congo Free State. Peace, order, progress, industrious work followed in his wake. He did this all in just 5.5 years. He established 5 stations stretching over 450 miles inland. He launched a steamer and a sailboat on the upper Congo above Stanley Pool. A road was built between Viva and Isangili. Even the wild and warlike Bangala made treaties with Bula Matari. Nobody wanted to fight him again. Through his perseverance, diplomacy, patience, and understanding of the tribes of the Congo, he brought civilization to the tattooed and naked savages who had lived in barbarous depravity and cannibalism for centuries, maybe millenniums. Stanley was hailed worldwide as the emancipator, the liberator, who had ended the rampant intertribal slavery and Arab slave trade which had plundered the Congo for centuries. In his lifetime, he is considered one of the greatest freedom fighters ever. Today, he's cursed as one of the worst colonialists in history. Interesting how perspectives change over centuries. By the time his 5 years in the Congo was completed, Stanley had built a line of garrison stations for 1,400 miles up the Congo, established peace between tribes who had been in constant warfare for centuries. Generations. He had established a far-reaching political and commercial organization. He built roads, railways, launched 2 steamers on the upper Congo, 3 on the lower Congo. He brought peace, commerce, law to a land that had once been wild and savage. Who could have imagined that this could have been done? Missionaries and traders were venturing up the river. C.T. Studd launched his Heart of Africa mission in the Congo as a result of the civilization that Stanley was able to establish. Trading posts, mission stations, where no one would have thought possible just a few short years before. Stanley's choice of successor was General Charles Gordon of the Sudan, who was en route to take over from Stanley when the Mahdi's rebellion in the Sudan forced him to change his plans, head for his fatal date with destiny in Khartoum. But that's another story. Stanley regretted that many of his ideals and the principles of David Livingstone, which he had sought to honor, were betrayed by the men who followed him. And it does need to be said. Not everyone who followed Stanley in the Congo were true to these ideals. That's a fact. But it's not fair to blame Stanley for the fact that others later departed from these fine traditions that he tried to honor. In 1910, King Leopold persuaded the Belgian government to take responsibility for administering the Congo. Now, it's interesting. King Leopold might be even more controversial in some ways, because in his lifetime, he was honored as a great emancipator, sponsoring out of personal wealth the Congo Free State, because the Belgian government wasn't willing to do it, said, we don't have the money for it. Today, they've got books like King Leopold's Ghost, damning him to hell because of all the evils that he perpetrated in the Congo. Well, whether he did or people under him, there certainly were evils that took place. It was a wild place, and some of the people who took over obviously didn't have principles, weren't inspired by Livingstone or the Bible. Was King Leopold a hero, an emancipator? Was he an evil colonial exploiter? I mean, that's another story to be judged, and I've not looked into him. But I certainly think Stanley had altruistic motives. Incredibly, that was not the end of the African adventure of Henry Morton Stanley. He later crossed Africa from the Atlantic to the Indian Ocean to rescue one of General Gordon's governors, Emin Pasha. And we don't have time to look at that tonight. But that epic of endurance started out with an expedition of 708 men, ended with 196. 512 died en route. The afflictions, the diseases, the battles endured on Emin Pasha rescue compare with Stanley's expedition of the Congo. That was Emin Pasha, was one of General Gordon's governors in Equatoria, but he was cut off when the Mahdi took over the whole of Sudan, and so to rescue him, the only way they could get to him was from the Congo, because the Arabs controlled the north. And so this was the rescue of Emin Pasha, the last of General Gordon's governors. Well, Stanley and his men were welcomed to German East Africa, Tanganyika and Bagamoyo by the guns of the German warships in the harbour, which boomed out a salute to this epic explorer. He then wrote 900 pages of In Darkest Africa, which we also have here original copies of, but that's, again, for another day. But on that mission, he noted that one of the most encouraging aspects of this Trans-Africa expedition was visiting the mission station of Reverend Alexander Mackay in Usambira, in Uganda. Mackay had been in Africa for 12 years. He came in response to Stanley's urgent plea for missionaries published in the Daily Telegraph after the conversion of Kabaka Mutesa. Stanley described Mackay as the best missionary since Livingstone. So he's worthy of a look on another occasion. And he did some extraordinary work. And today, you can actually see the Mackay Martyrs Church. This is the oldest church building in Uganda. Mackay Martyrs Church. Well, Stanley observed that the virtues of civilization never seem so clear as when he is in the jungle. And the wilds of Africa never seem so pleasant as when he is in the midst of civilization. He wasn't that happy in civilization, but he longed for civilization to come to the wilderness of Africa too. Stanley left with England, met with England's Prime Minister, William Gladstone, the grand old man, and urged him to build a railroad from Mombasa to the East African coast to the shore of Lake Victoria to help suppress the slave trade. At the age of 49, less than 3 months after his return to England from his last great African expedition, he married the talented and beautiful Dorothy Tennant at Westminster Abbey, 12th of July 1890. Dorothy Tennant was a descendant of Oliver Cromwell from her mother's side. Stanley received honorary degrees from Oxford, Cambridge, Edinburgh, Hull, Durham. He conducted lecture tours of the University of the United States, Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania. In 1895, he was elected a Member of Parliament for North Lambeth, London. But he was a man of action. He was not a politician. He accomplished far more by his writings than by speeches in Parliament. He didn't consider his parliamentary career as a success, and he never stood again. His book, Slavery and the Slave Trade in Africa, was effective in mobilizing the political will and action necessary to crush the last remnants of that vile trade in Africa. I learned by experience, he wrote, that there was no love for me, born, so to say, fatherless, spurned and disowned by my mother, beaten almost to death by my teacher and guardian, fed on the bread of bitterness. How was I to believe in love? But I was not sent into the world to be happy, nor to search for happiness. I was sent for a special work. In 1897, he paid his last visit to Africa to take part in the ceremonies opening the Bulawayo Railway Station in southern Rhodesia. His last book was Through South Africa, published in 1898. That's significant for me because I was brought up in Bulawayo. Rhodesia was founded just 7 years before that by people inspired by the example of Henry Morton Stanley and of Livingstone and his desire to bring civilization to the Dark Continent. Here you can see one of the great feats of that time, the Victoria Falls Bridge. Every piece of this bridge was constructed in England, shipped out and assembled. Imagine shipping it out here, assembled, and the last piece, the engineers even told what piece to place and at what time of the day as it swelled up, and that stood for, since 1903, taking pentechnicons, trains, anything across there. That's an amazing feat of planning. and engineering. But that was part of the goals of civilizing the continent, ending slavery, and these people considered humanitarians at that time. Today, they are damned as exploiters. So the question is, what's changed in the last century? In 1899, at the age of 58, Stanley was knighted by Queen Victoria. He died 10th of May 1904 at 63 years old. He is the most famous convert of Dr. David Livingstone, one of the greatest explorers of all time, one of the most effective campaigners against the slave trade. His 1874 to 1877 Trans-Africa exploit was the most outstanding achievement in all the history of the exploration of Africa, and anyone would agree that. This is his gravestone, Henry Morton Stanley Bulamatari, 1841 to 1904, Africa. That's all he wanted, or all his wife put on his stone. They brought this rock from Africa, and that's in Britain. In his autobiography, he wrote, "Those to whom I venture to consign the secret hopes and interests of my heart invariably betrayed me." Interesting attitude that he had. He did not trust people in Europe or America, but he had a lot of friends in Africa. Howe found Livingstone Central Africa is one of his books, Through the Dark Continent, another, in Darkest Africa, we have all these books. Here, Missionary Researchers in South Africa, Livingstone's book. There are books that examine Stanley. Some these days are trying to re-examine him in a critical way. These are some of his books, Kumasi and Magdala. Sir Henry Morton Stanley, Confederate. Interesting. So he was British and American. Then you get these books that try to hack him to pieces, Dark Safari and others, The Impossible Life of Africa's Greatest Explorer. Some of these books are trying to do psychological analysis and you could say twist the story. There are other good books that we've got on the subject of missions. There's one film made on Stanley's quest for Livingstone. Recently I am looking for it. And there's a 1930s one on Stanley and Livingstone, a black and white, which I would like to get hold of. But those are just some of the resources. You get this article on our Frontline website and on the ReformationSA.org website. Any questions? That's an incredible 400-slide report on Stanley. Any questions, comments, criticisms, complaints? Yes.
It's nice to actually see how the lies that you get told about how before colonialism everybody lived in peace and harmony, and then the evil colonialists came and upset the apple cart, and that's why Africa's got its problems that it's got today. It's nonsense. There was no, the life was excruciatingly worse before the likes of Livingstone and Stanley and all the other explorers opened up, and actually,
yes,
it was excruciating.
I think it is absolutely essential for anyone who wants to understand African history to read Livingstone's travels and to read Stanley's Through the Dark Continent. I think until you have done that, you don't know what was going on. You need a contemporary to tell you what it was like before the gospel reached these areas. And of course, we do have such books talking about what Britain was like before the gospel got there, for that matter.
No, it's much the same.
It's pretty bad. Yeah. We take a lot of things for granted. But to say such as our dear friend, the dictator of Zambia, Kenneth Gonda, said, a humanist in Africa, he said, the people of Africa knew nothing about suffering until the missionaries arrived. Well, that's nice propaganda, but is that true? Vladimir Lenin is the one who propagated this idea that Europe is rich because of colonialism and Africa is poor because of being colonialized. That's a nice theory, but it just falls to pieces with every example you look at. Hordes and hordes of colonies are very wealthy today. America was once a colony, Canada was once a colony,
New Zealand,
Australia, South Africa, Hong Kong. Many countries are colonies, and it only did them good. Singapore's doing pretty well. And so on. So being a colony doesn't necessarily make you unsuccessful. Then similarly, many countries are very, very, very well off with high standards of living who never had colonies. Switzerland never had a colony. Most of Scandinavia never had colonies. So what is this proof? And yes, Africa has suffered some things because of colonialism, but it has benefited far more. If you think about what it was before, who would have wanted to have one-third the life expectancy of what they have today? And that's what it was like. Mm. It's very exciting to read about King Shaka, but who would have wanted to live under
Yeah, exactly.
Masilla Kazi and Lubin Gula were tough tyrants. You wouldn't have wanted to live under them. And would we really want to be running around barefoot, dancing on thorns, and executed if you show a sign of pain, as Shaka did in people? You know, is that reasonable, throwing people off high rocks and so on? So if people like shoes, glasses, cell phones, antibiotics, long life expectancy, good professional medical care, then why are they whinging and whining about the people who actually laid the railways and built the bridges and established law and order? So Europe did a lot for Africa, and while I've got some complaints with especially how Europe abandoned Africa and some of the heinous things Europe did in Africa, like how they treated the Boers in the Anglo-Boer War and the Rhodesians and a few other things like that, there's sometimes that Europe was brutal in Africa, yet the people of Africa benefited overwhelmingly. The big picture is, never in history has any continent done as much for another continent to turbo boost them from the Stone Age and Iron Age into the Space Age. In just a couple of generations, life expectancy was tripled. Literacy went from 0 to 60, 70, 80%. Incredible achievement. So if you think of, I've heard of the word the scars of colonialism, think of the roads, the railways, the schools, the hospitals, the law courts, the written language, the enormous amounts of benefits. And how many of us here in this room are alive because of some medical technology? And how many of us wouldn't be alive if there wasn't respect for law and order to the extent it is? You may not think law and order is great, but it's better than it was in the Congo in the 1870s.
Another thing, Europeans also must also consider, you take Britain, for instance. How great was Britain 1,200 years ago, before 1,800 years ago, before actually Rome conquered them and actually brought a measure of roads and a little bit of order that actually allowed the gospel to move quicker there, you know. So
a lot of other invasions since.
Yeah, well,
the Vikings were doing devastation just 1,000 years ago.
I mean, the thing is, every little group has been. If you take Europe, for instance, all the countries, they've all had pagan tribes that needed to be subdued.
Why did they need to be subdued?
well, quite obvious.
I think the word subdued may be an unfair term.
2011 value systems to judge what happened in history.
I don't think value systems are relative to...
You are judging history.
Yeah, but I mean,
statements are judging history. If you lived in those days,
of course,
you wouldn't have looked at it the way you're looking at it.
Absolutely,
now.
Yes. Yes. Well, that's exactly what.
No, it's true, but the point is,
it's terribly easy to condemn history.
It's true, but the point is, what is happening today is there's a condemning of people who at the time thought that they were doing something very good. And in fact, even from the
But our friend Stanley kills people. That's wrong. According to the Bible, no Christian kills another human being.
Okay.
He kills
people. So what should he have done?
Christian murders. There's a big difference. I mean, the thing is,
should Stanley have just stayed in Europe or America, not come to Africa?
I don't know. I'm listening to you.
Would Africa be better off if he had just stayed home? Would it have been better if Livingstone had stayed home?
Are missionaries good?
That's a question.
That's a valid question.
It is. And obviously, not all are equal. Some, no doubt, have done immensely good work. We look at some of them. In fact, we'll be looking at C.T. Studd and Mary Slessor in future weeks, some missionaries who were exemplary in what they achieved. But... surely there's some missionaries who are appalling.
Sorry, I'm stirring, but I was...
You're welcome to stir.
With you two, you know.
You're welcome to stir.
You're welcome. I mean, the thing is, I don't take back any of my statements. That's what I said. I'm saying it in 2011, because we are in 2011. And yes, that is what I'm saying. The nations, those pagan nations, and where would we be? I mean, I'm from Anglo-Saxon descent. The Anglo-Saxons, the Saxons were savages. They needed to be have another group and bring a measure of order there, and then later on a measure of Christianity to allow that. It worked out. It actually worked out better.
Well, okay, what is good and bad? If we just take the Ten Commandments as a standard of right and wrong, you know, don't steal another man's life, don't steal another man's wife, don't steal his property, don't steal his good name, don't be jealous and envious of his neighbor. You know, basic Ten Commandments, do to others what you want to be done unto. Is it good to have respect for life and property? If it is, which is a Ten Commandments principle, then the fact that we have moved from where tyrants, kings could just have human sacrifices like King Kofi and Ashanti, you know, wiping out vast amounts of his own people, where that could be brought to an end, that could be an improvement. And where you could have respect for rights to life, and where even a common citizen could call his head of state to adhere to the law, and could have the law courts find in his favor. And where even a head of state could be arraigned and brought before the courts, as they've even had presidents in America impeached, which is a very nice idea. Something that you couldn't have considered under the old tyrants. And however corrupt we have systems today, the fact that there is a semblance of law and an attempt to adhere to basic standards, and that corruption can be called corruption, and that you don't have the right to just arbitrarily kill your neighbour, that's surely a great improvement. Mm. I mean, which of us would have really liked to have lived under the conditions that prevailed at that time?
You don't think what's going on in the ganglands is just as bad?
I think it's a regression back to the law of the jungle, yes. I think it's terrible. In fact, that's exactly what it is. It's going back to pre-civilization. It's shocking and it's unacceptable.
To you and to so-called civilization.
Yes.
But to them, you know, where they are, they don't know any difference.
They probably don't.
They're oblivious to your thought process.
That's true. But there are people who are being robbed, murdered, raped, victims of these gangs. For their sakes, should one not try to bring these people a higher way of living? Isn't conversion and civilization a good thing if it's going to stop that kind of law of the jungle?
I don't know, maybe civilization is what you're talking about on the other side.
Well, to me, civilization should be one of the fruits of good gospel work. If you can change the heart of man, you should see a change in his thought patterns and then his behavior and his actions. So we don't believe you can change things from the outside in, but from the inside out.
That's correct. You know, it doesn't matter which religion you take. Perhaps you want to use Christianity as a vehicle.
We do, yes.
Yes, no, granted. And I respect that. You know, the thing is that you're going through, you're going there to be able to bring your peace offerings or your religion, but you know, at what cost?
At what cost? We've got to ask, is the cost worth it? And I mean, honestly and truly, of the people...
What about the cost? It's worth it.
You think of the cost of how many people died on expedition like that, how many missionaries died, how many explorers were murdered, and there's a lot of examples of that. But...
And like that lady said, how many were murdered?
Sorry?
And like the lady there said, how many were murdered?
How many were murdered, indeed.
On a more positive note,
mm-hmm.
something that I've always found interesting to observe is that through colonialism, that the English language spread around the world. And had that not happened, where would the world be today if it weren't for that spread of the English language? Where, say, for example, you go to a place like India, I don't know, they have 800 different languages there?
332.
332.
Right. 1,800 in Indonesia.
The common language is Indian, yeah. Now, where would Africa be if the common language...
3,000 languages in Africa.
And then you still have French and Spanish, but...
Well, those are unifying languages, at least.
Yeah.
Commercial languages. Yeah. Second or third languages. Well, this is the thing. I grew up with an attitude that colonialism was bad, and we were particularly critical of the Brits, and in particular where I grew up, because we were in Rhodesia, and we had a real... axe to grind about how they treated us. Yeah, we fought for them in the First and Second World War and the Malayan conflicts, and when our back was against the wall, they supported our enemies, sanctioned us, wouldn't even let us play Olympics or rugby. And, you know, we thought I grew up with a lot of real anger, but as I travel to Nigeria, I'm told, oh, the British didn't come here to colonize us, they came and made us a protectorate. Our king asked them to come to end the Portuguese slave trade here, to end the slave market and set the people free. In fact, the name Nigeria came from the British governor, really. And the people spoke about the time the British were there like it was a good thing. Interesting. Went to Sudan. People in Sudan team, they spoke about the 58 years under British rule, especially General Gordon Pasha, as the best time they ever had. The only time they were free from corrupt, slave-dealing Arabs who had oppressed them. So the black people of Sudan were incredibly positive about their colonial experience. So I started to have to think, well, maybe there's another side. And so looking into these things, I've developed a more positive view towards the colonial experience in general.
That on its head, did colonialism in South Africa not bring the slaves here too? From Malaysia, Indonesia and so on?
The Malays, yes. That was done. Yes, the Dutch used the Cape, like the British used Australia, as part of their criminal justice system. Anyone who caused trouble, whether criminals or political,
all the slaves
they shipped
criminals.
Them off. Sorry?
All the slaves that came here weren't criminals, were they?
They were.
The Dutch brought
the Malays here. They've either fallen foul of the government in one way or the other, whether it was criminal or whether it was political agitation or rebels. So they fell into the broad category of criminal justice system, which obviously at that stage was a very harsh system. But that's what they did. They took anyone who caused trouble in their homeland and they shipped them to the outer areas. And at one time the British tried to ship criminals here to the Cape, and the people in the Cape were strong enough that they said, no.
Because many of the Indonesians here came from the royal family at that time.
Well, they would have been under the rebel side.
Yeah, exactly. Depending on how you view history. But just to say to you that, you know, I don't know much about anything. My daughter is a Rhodes scholar. She had to do an essay on Rhodes and on Mandela. It's now Mandela Rhodes scholar. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, she's got one on the left-hand side, which is Rhodes. She's got one on the right, which is Mandela. Now the Dalai Lama, should we take the money and go? Eventually we took the money. So I don't know.
Cecil Rhodes was a great man, but he wasn't a good man.
Exactly.
Well, there's this magnificent property up here that he gave to the country.
Well, that
there's only one ANC guy who's given any property.
Well, that's another story.
Well, yes, they might be better taking it. But yes, I'm not a great fan of Cecil John Rhodes in terms of his ethics. But I must say this, he was far-sighted and visionary, and he built and Kirstenbosch Gardens and Rhodes Memorial and University of Cape Town, and there's a lot of things he left behind. And the man didn't enrich himself. You've got to say that. He was someone who had a vision. Yeah, he wanted to bring America back under Britain, and he wanted to have railway from Cape to Cairo. He had vision, education, all that sort of thing, and he didn't live elegantly himself. He put it all into the cause. I mean, I wish he had put it into the kingdom of God and not just into his...
Yeah, there you wanted a convert.
That he would have been a great...
tell you.
If you could have had that energy channeled in something more altruistic.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a selfish person. He was a visionary.
Yeah.
But I think of Rhodes as a great man, not a good man, not an example that I would want to follow. But his energy and his vision, if used for a good cause, would have been great.
Yeah.